Greetings, fellow amateurs, and welcome to another episode of the Amateur Society. I'm your host, Stephen Menking, and I'm flying solo here today for the purpose of introducing you to another facet of the Amateur Society's mission that I think you'll find both interesting, challenging, and compelling. One of the key motivating factors that led me to start the Amateur Society was the confusion that results when we begin to talk about worldview issues. And one of those crucial worldview issues in our society is how we view science. What is science? What is it used for? What are its limitations? What are its benefits? All of these questions are seemingly obvious. We're taught science from a very young age in school, and the doctrine of science that we're given is that science is a fully objective, perfectly reliable barometer of what is true and what is false. Now, there are some exceptions to those rules, but generally I find that to be the case. It's very important as a Christian to have the ability to interface with science in order to address some of the many base-level criticisms of the Christian worldview that are leveled commonly by opponents from all sides of the spectrum. Christians are typically labeled as anti-science or backward or Luddites or being on the wrong side of history, quote-unquote, as it pertains to scientific developments. Various examples will be cited, including the Catholic Church's opposition to Galileo and his discoveries, all the way up through the Scopes monkey trial at the beginning of the 20th century about the teachings of evolution, and all the way through today. This broadcast marks the beginning of a series in which I will be investigating scientific results from across the spectrum, from a variety of disciplines, including cosmology, physics, geology, and even social sciences, like psychiatry, psychology, sociology, and many others, where I attempt, as best I can, to translate academic jargon into conclusions that can be practically understood and then applied. Oftentimes, we run into a problem when we hear or learn about quote-unquote new science that's being done, or generally the way that science is presented and perceived in the general populace and in our culture at large. Science is often portrayed as the final or the sole arbiter of truth, and that if science has quote-unquote spoken on a matter, then the science is settled. We've certainly heard that moniker or that phrase applied to a wide variety of issues. However, that phrase itself is entirely unscientific. It's inconsistent with the general scientific method and the philosophy of science that sets out what we can know and what we can't know based on various experiments that can be conducted or various theories that can be developed. It's extremely important for Christians and people in general to understand that scientism, or the worldview of scientific naturalism, that states that science is the only way to truth and that all other claims to truth need to be abandoned or severely discounted, it's critical for us to understand that this really is a false, self-contradictory, or in the best case scenario, a worldview that lacks a significant amount of explanatory power. One of the best resources that I've found that looks at these worldview questions, particularly the difference between scientific naturalism and a generic kind of theism is a book called Where the Conflict Really Lies by Alvin Plantinga, a Christian philosopher who put forth some new and exciting and powerful theories about epistemology, that is, the study of how we know things, what it means to know something, how we come to know what we know, and questions about knowledge in general. Reading from the preface here, Plantinga writes, "Some treat science as if it were a sort of infallible oracle, like a divine revelation. Or if not infallible, since it seems so regularly to change its mind, at any rate such that when it comes to fixing belief, science is the court of last appeal. But this can't be right. First, science doesn't address some of the topics where we most need enlightenment. Religion, politics, and morals, for example. Many look to scientists for guidance on matters outside of science, matters on which scientists have no special expertise. They apparently think of scientists as the new priestly class. Unsurprisingly, scientists don't ordinarily discourage this tendency. But of course, a scientist pontificating on matters outside her field is no better than anyone else pontificating on matters outside her field. Second, science contradicts itself, both over time and at the same time. Two of the most important and overarching contemporary scientific theories are general relativity and quantum mechanics. Both are highly confirmed and enormously impressive. Unfortunately, they can't both be correct." So what Plantinga is highlighting here is something that I've brought up many times and something that is at the core of the mission of the Amateur Society. And it's not that science has no validity, but rather we have to take various results and proclamations in their proper context and evaluate them as they should be evaluated without extending overdue or unwarranted explanatory power and explanatory scope to something that really is a more limited conclusion. And what I'd like to do today is turn to a specific result, a paper that was published in the journal The New Atlantis this fall, that addresses a highly complex, challenging, and controversial aspect of human nature. An aspect of human nature that has become the highlight of the culture wars and a key component of some of the harshest and most bitter divisions in our society. The topic at hand is sexuality and gender. Now, as a Christian, what's my motivation for doing this? My motivation, not only as a Christian, but as someone who is interested in finding out the truth, is to study these very important aspects of humanity in order to determine what can properly be demonstrated through the scientific process. And as it turns out, these concepts, such as sexuality, are far from being thoroughly understood and studied, really don't even have concrete, proper definitions to the point where they can be studied. I'm going to focus on what this scientific report says and what conclusions we are justified in drawing from it. And then at the end, I will begin to discuss in brief how this interacts with my approach to these issues as a Christian. So, first, a brief introduction on the two gentlemen who put this study together. The first is Dr. Lawrence S. Mayer. He's a scholar in residence in the Department of Psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and a professor of statistics and biostatistics at Arizona State University. He is a biostatistician and epidemiologist who focuses on the design, analysis, and interpretation of experimental and observational data in public health and medicine, particularly when the data are complex in terms of underlying scientific issues. The second author is Dr. Paul R. McHugh. He is the University Distinguished Service Professor of Psychiatry and a Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He was, for 25 years, the psychiatrist-in-chief at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. Dr. McHugh was elected a member of the National Academy of Medicine, formerly the Institute of Medicine, in 1992. From 2002 to 2009, he was a member of the President's Council on Bioethics. So, argument from authority is not valid by itself. However, presenting the qualifications of the authors does help us to understand that these are serious researchers with extensive clinical and scientific experience. They are well acquainted with the literature, and they're not just mere amateurs like myself. What I'm going to attempt to do is distill some conclusions from this report. The name of the report is Sexuality and Gender: Findings from the Biological, Psychological, and Social Sciences. The first thing to examine is to note that this is a particular kind of academic report. It is a literature survey. So, what that means is that Dr. Mayer and Dr. McHugh are not performing their own individual experiments. We won't have to get into an analysis of experimental design. What we will be talking about in this part one is sexuality and sexual identity. This, as the authors discuss, is an incredibly challenging topic to understand. Here is a brief piece from the introduction that covers an array of examples. While some people are under the impression that sexual orientation is an innate, fixed, and biological trait of human beings, that whether heterosexual, homosexual, or bisexual, we are born that way, there is insufficient scientific evidence to support that claim. In fact, the concept of sexual orientation itself is highly ambiguous. It can refer to a set of behaviors, to feelings of attraction, or to a sense of identity. Epidemiological studies show a rather modest association between genetic factors and sexual attractions or behaviors, but do not provide significant evidence pointing to particular genes. There is also evidence for other hypothesized biological causes of homosexual behaviors, attractions, or identity, such as the influence of hormones on prenatal development, but that evidence, too, is limited. Studies of the brains of homosexuals and heterosexuals have found some differences, but have not demonstrated that these differences are inborn rather than the result of environmental factors that influence both psychological and neurobiological traits. One environmental factor that appears to be correlated with non-heterosexuality is childhood sexual abuse victimization, which may also contribute to the higher rates of poor mental health outcomes among non-heterosexual subpopulations compared to the general population. Overall, the evidence suggests some measure of fluidity in patterns of sexual attraction and behavior, contrary to the born-that-way notion that oversimplifies the vast complexity of human sexuality. There's a lot to get into there, and some critics of this report have attempted to discredit the findings. But when you actually dig into the report, what the authors present is a compelling case by looking at various research that has been done across several scientific disciplines that arrives ultimately at the conclusion that despite attempts to do so, there is no clear scientific evidence for sexuality being a fixed biological innate trait. And what this means is there hasn't been enough demonstrated to show either that there is a sequence of genes associated with sexuality, that there is a particular brain function or portion of the brain that's associated with sexuality, or any other genetic or biological markers. that are concrete enough to arrive at the conclusion of a causal link between the biological factor and stated sexual identity. There are a couple aspects of this that deserve some additional attention. The first is the notion of correlation versus causation. Now, in statistics, you can find that two variables are correlated. For instance, height and weight have a positive correlation. When height goes up, weight tends to go up as well. Now, this doesn't mean that you can't find a tall person who weighs less than someone who's shorter, but it just describes the general trend of the data. Now, if you've taken statistics at every level, you will have been taught that correlation is not enough to properly determine causation. In order to say that A causes B, you would have to eliminate all the other potential pathways. You have to show something extremely concrete. And the standards of causation are much higher than correlation and much more difficult to meet. And so we end up at a spot where in studying sexuality, we find that there are various correlations, but that causation continues to be elusive from a scientific sense. For instance, one of the correlations that was mentioned in the discussion of sexuality from these authors, there is an environmental factor that's correlated with non-heterosexuality, and that is childhood sexual abuse. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that every person who is abused as a child is going to, later on in their life, identify as a non-heterosexual. And it also doesn't mean that everyone who identifies as a non-heterosexual has been abused as a child. All that it shows is that when you take a large sample of the population and you survey people about their sexual identity and their past experiences, you find that a greater proportion of those who responded that they identified as something other than heterosexual had experiences with childhood sexual abuse. The primary point is that this survey data only tells us that this association exists, not what the causes are. Those definitive explanations continue to be elusive, and depending on your ideology or your worldview, you would ascribe different factors and different channels by which the causality would take place. And what's really difficult in this and many other instances relating to these complex subjects is that causality can often run in reverse. Many times you'll see a disagreement between people about a complicated subject of human nature, and one will say, oh, well, A causes B. And the other will say, oh, no, B causes A. And it's extremely challenging to distinguish between the two because both of those would explain a correlation or a relationship between A and B. However, what this certainly does tell us is that this subject is extremely important from a public health perspective, and that is in line with the association and the correlation of alternative sexual preferences with both childhood sexual abuse, but also elevated rates of suicide. Now, it's perhaps this latter case where you see the arguments back and forth most clearly. One side would potentially argue that the alternative lifestyle that those who identify as non-heterosexual participate in is in and of itself dangerous, risky, and subject to adverse outcomes. Others would argue that these negative outcomes occur as a result of cultural pressure or societal stigmatization that leads to negative mental and physical health outcomes. In either case, what's important to consider is that these outcomes exist, this disparity exists, and that it needs to be addressed. And so what the science has done in this case is highlight clearly that there is a problem. However, the science is not capable at the current moment of evaluating the exact cause. In order to get the answer to that, you have to step outside the realm of science. Part of what allows us to see the divide here is that the definitions of sexual identity are so various that it makes studying these things in the same way that we would study magnetism or electricity, for instance, borderline impossible. Not to mention the fact that we're measuring a human response to something based on an arbitrary scale. From the study, we read that one of the central difficulties in examining and researching sexual orientation is that the underlying concepts of sexual desire, sexual attraction, and sexual arousal can be ambiguous. And it is even less clear what it means that a person identifies as having a sexual orientation grounded in some pattern of desires, attractions, or states of arousal. Now, even when the definition is potentially expanded to include present or past activities, relationship status, and everything else, that doesn't immediately clarify the matter at all. But if we're trying to identify things and attempting to clarify what we mean by sexual desire, sexual attraction, and sexual arousal, even that runs into definitional problems. The authors cite various examples from the literature where definitions have been used for sexual desire that are widely disparate. One, states of physical arousal that may or may not be linked to a specific physical activity and may or may not be objects of conscious awareness. Two, conscious erotic interest in response to finding others attractive, in perception, memory, or fantasy, which may or may not involve any of the bodily processes associated with measurable states of physical arousal. Three, strong interest in finding a companion or establishing a durable relationship. Four, the romantic aspirations and feelings associated with infatuation or falling in love with a specific individual. Five, inclination towards attachment to specific individuals. Six, the general motivation to seek intimacy with a member of some specific group. Or C, an aesthetic measure that latches on to perceived beauty in others. Clearly, while some of these definitions share similarities, it really doesn't tell us a whole lot about anything. So, in order to conduct a proper scientific examination, we have to have terminology that is clear and definitions that are widely accepted, and better yet, universally accepted. Unfortunately, at this time, the clinical definition of sexual identity involves so many different aspects or potential aspects that it makes performing scientific evaluations that would be capable of establishing causation extremely tenuous. Ultimately, the study says, in sum, the complexities surrounding the concept of sexual orientation present considerable challenges for empirical research on the subject. While the general public may be under the impression that there are widely accepted scientific definitions of terms such as sexual orientation, in fact, they're not. The authors then cite a 2003 study and say that it is still true today that there is currently no scientific or popular consensus on the exact constellation of experiences that definitively qualify an individual as lesbian, gay, or bisexual. So, if we can't clarify the concept of sexual orientation with scientific methods, then ultimately we have to get it from someplace else. And the issue that we run into when we're presenting scientific results, or when scientific results are published in media outlets or presented as popular science, they're taken as definitive, and the claims that they make are presented as definitive, when in fact, there is no such justification for doing that. Generally speaking, from a Christian perspective, sexuality seems to be either what God defines it as, or as anything we want. It's so ambiguous that if we try to define it using our own understanding, essentially we can come to any conclusion that we'd like to. And ultimately, because of this, it makes scientific research on the subject extremely challenging, as no strict definitions exist the way they do with more concrete phenomena. Moving on to the latter portion of this study, there is an extensive review of various aspects of the literature, including items of causality, some of which we've already discussed. I'd like to review a couple of the key findings here. The first critical finding is that after looking into a large body of research on various attempts to link biological markers such as genes or brain activity or hormones to sexual identity, the authors conclude that the results are inconclusive. Essentially, the authors were unable to find any studies that demonstrated conclusively that something as complicated as sexual identity can be distilled into one biological mechanism or the other. Now, based on the variability of these studies, and we don't have time to get into various aspects such as confidence intervals and probability analysis and those sorts of methodologies, the main finding was that there was evidence that demonstrates that, in part, sexual identity can be linked with innate biological nature. However, the explanatory power of biological factors ended up being very small relative to environmental factors. So this is the justification for the conclusion that the authors draw, that there is insufficient scientific evidence to support the born that way hypothesis. There is an extra wrinkle here in that our understanding of the field of genetics and heritability and how our genes actually translate from genotype to phenotype, or the physical expression of those genes, has a great deal to do with our environment and our experiences throughout the course of our lives. This is the science and study that is known as epigenetics, and it's extremely important because it speaks to the common fallacy that has been proposed by popular science literature, including that of Richard Dawkins, that claims that we are nothing more as humans than a conglomeration of DNA, and that we simply dance to its music. Well, it turns out that if we dance to the music of our DNA, a better analogy would be that our DNA is a type of instrument and a type of piano, and it is our life experiences, and from a Christian perspective, it is the work of God that orchestrates the functioning of this instrument. So yes, the instrument is important. It has a function and it has concrete mechanisms. However, it is our epigenetic experience that explains and deals with a fuller aspect of who we are as a person, including sexual identity, than any one concrete fixed biological factor. So ultimately, the results that the authors find after looking through the full body of research on this topic is that the evidence to support the nature hypothesis over nurture in the form of sexual identity is insufficient. They don't draw any conclusions that declare that such biological factors have no part to play, in part because of the normal scientific process where something that is currently misunderstood or undiscovered could yet occur or appear in research or experimentation in the future. But at the moment, the breadth and depth of the scientific literature on the topic of sexual identity does not demonstrate that there is an innate biological connection that has been found, proved, tested, and verified. So where does that lead us? As we move forward in this series, I will be discussing some additional aspects of this study and moving into further areas of research. Other things that we will end up discussing include some more formal experimental design aspects, like why do people always use twin studies, and some statistical analysis aspects, such as what is a confidence interval and what does it mean? And that applies not just to science, but to popular statistics as you see them reported most recently and most prevalently in terms of political polling. And above all, we will be continuing our attempt to translate scientific research in its proper context into a form that is more generally comprehensible and cuts through the jargon of these subjects that can often be incredibly complex and sometimes even deliberately so. That's all for me for this episode of the Amateur Society. You can follow our work on WordPress, amateursociety.wordpress.com, or you can look us up on Facebook and stay tuned for more here on Spreaker. We thank you again for joining us. This is Stephen Menking signing off. To God be the glory.